How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing so well. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing great, Lance. In this episode today, we talk to our buddy, a colleague, a friend. His name is Josh Hallmark, and he does a fantastic true crime podcast called True Crime Bullshit.
It's so great to have someone like Josh in our universe. He is the personification of organized when it comes to researching his topics. He especially puts a lot of time into Israel Keyes, the notorious serial killer, and he's so easy to talk to, and it makes these conversations really fun to have and also very informative.
That's right, and this episode is going to air on both Crawl Space and Missing Maura Murray because we do talk about Israel Keyes in connection to Brianna Maitland, which is primarily a Crawl Space series that we aired here, and then Maura Murray, obviously, is a topic that we discuss in depth, Lance, on our podcast, Missing Maura Murray.
So our conversation does touch upon Israel Keyes being ruled out of either one of those disappearances. But Josh does drop a little bit of a nugget that I didn't know about, which was that Israel Keyes had access to a small airplane, which kind of opens up some other doors of opportunities.
It really does, Lance. And we know based on the FBI's website that Israel Keyes was actually on a trip when Maura Murray went missing. And his trips, he sometimes would kill people during those trips. He would fly somewhere, rent a car, and then drive somewhere. And I do think it's pretty unlikely still, the connection to Maura Murray. But speaking with Josh, it's probably a little more possible than I realized. Okay, everybody, so make sure to check out Josh Hallmark's show. It's called True Crime Bullshit. There are links in the show notes. Thanks a lot. Welcome back to the podcast, Josh Hallmark of True Crime Bullshit. What's going on?
Hey, guys, not a lot. What's going on with you?
You are such a liar. You just said, hey, guys, not a lot. Right before we started recording, you're like, I got to hire somebody because I am taking on too much and things are getting out of control.
Yeah, no, I actually just finished wasting an hour complaining about how I don't have time to my partner. So I am a liar. Too much is going on.
Well, the last time we interviewed you here on these airwaves, we spoke about a season of True Crime Bullshit, your fantastic podcast, that was not about Israel Keyes. It was about serial killer Kelly Cochran. And so I guess tell us where we are now in the trajectory of your show.
Yeah, so, you know, I Keyes, I think, is someone you could spend multiple seasons doing and barely scratch the surface on. And I think when I came into it, gosh, 3 years ago, I had always just anticipated doing one season because I didn't want to be like, episode 246, Keyes ate a granola bar in South Dakota on Monday.
Wait, what are you trying to say?
Nothing. Why?
Nothing. Well, just because this episode's probably going to be called episode 236. Josh Hallmark talks about Israel Keyes eating a granola bar.
That was always the thing. Like, you know, quit while I'm ahead. But I realized the more I did it, there's just an endless mine of material with him. So. After the second season, I had a lot of leads, but I wanted to really create, I guess, a more robust season on Keyes and make sure I had enough material to warrant doing a third season on him. So I took a break so I could investigate him and told the story of Kelly Cochran, which was a soul-sucking, exhausting experience. She is wildly interesting, and there's some comedic value to that story, but it just sucked the life out of me. So when that was over, I had continued researching Keyes, found a lot of great information, some really big new revelations, and figured, all right, it's time to return to the Keyes story.
That's really interesting, because when we had spoken last, you were talking about how you were, I guess, preparing for how soul-sucking that experience was going to be. I do want to get into Keyes a little bit down the line here, but can you give us some examples of what you went through as you were researching and producing season two?
Yeah, so from the jump, it was pretty bad. It took, I think, 6 or 7 months for the FOIA files to come in, and they were excruciatingly expensive. I think all in all it costs like $4,000 to get them, but because, as you know, production schedules, you can't just call your advertisers and be like, hey, I don't have the files yet, so we're gonna have to press pause. So I had to start the season without the files, which was not how I like to do things. And then once the files came in, it was just so such a huge information dump that I was producing while going through just, I think, 10,000 pages of documentation and like 40 hours of interviews. And the thing with Kelly is, you know, Keyes lies, but he lies to cover things up, as to where Kelly lies just for the joy of lying. And so it was harder to understand or even find a utility to her lies. Like with Keyes, when he's lying, it usually means something, and then you can go into like, what is he trying to hide and why is he saying this? As to where Kelly, you're like, she's lying just to lie. And it just reached a point where I felt pretty confident that I was not going to make any progress in the investigation. And with Keyes, you know, we had found all these victims that were very likely his, and, you know, hit the road and found places where he likely buried kill kits and bodies. And with Kelly, it was just like hour 18 and we still had not really found anything out about her, except that she lies more often than I anticipated she lied. So it just became very exhausting. And she is kind of an asshole. Like, and, you know, all serial killers are assholes, but Kelly was just, it was excruciating at listening to her talk.
And you never had any actual contact with her on the phone or anything like that?
No, I'd written her multiple letters, which she never responded to. And I keep anticipating, I haven't been to my P.O. box in like a month. And I'm like, oh gosh, I'm going to go in there and there's going to be a bunch of letters and artwork from her.
Yeah, probably at some point.
That's crazy how deep you get into these things. You had said that you started your season without the FOIA files, and that's something that you don't typically like to do. That must have just made you feel like so off right from the get-go, just because that's not what you do. You know, you want to be prepared as you go into it. If you had received those and you looked everything over, do you think you would have had second thoughts just in just overall about the season, or do you think that would have told you anything about her that...
That's a great question. I don't think if I had received the files before production started, I would have changed anything, just because the story is really interesting. And there's, you know, with Keyes, it's a very dry investigation, I guess, in that it's for the most part, he's a pretty standard serial killer, and I hate talking about it in these terms, but, you know, narratively speaking, it's just a pretty classic investigation. As to where with Kelly, we had, like, weird cannibalism and affairs and her drugging people, and it just was a dynamic story in a very different way from what I was used to. So I think even now, knowing what I know and knowing how exhausting it was doing that season, I would do it all over again. I just maybe would be a little more prepared and hedge my expectations better.
Okay, but so now you're in your wheelhouse a little bit more? You feel like you're back in your comfort zone covering Keys in season four?
Yeah, I do. And again, it goes back to, like, is there story to tell? And halfway through the Kelly season, I was like, I think we're out of story. And with Keys, I'm like, oh man, we still have so much more story to tell. And that's really invigorating and inspiring.
Good. Tell us where you're at. It's probably a big question, but what's rolling around in your noggin right now?
Well, I think going into the season, we found out some very big information. Also, because of quarantine, I was able to get out on the road, which I've never done before, and drive to a lot of these locations. I live in the Northeast, where his family had a home, he had a home, he did a lot of his criminal activity. So I got to get out on the road and see places and meet some people who are close to the case and close to Keys. We also found out through some sources that Keys had access to a private plane, which was like a huge bombshell, because here's this guy who travels to kill people and his timeline seemed really limited. And we were trying to figure out, like, how is he in all these places, yet there's no travel records putting him there? And finding out he had access to a private plane and was on it at least a few times, we're still trying to dig into the records, because unfortunately the FAA doesn't require pilots to keep A, manifest, but B, even their flight records for more than 3 years. So that's been a new task.
Was this private plane like a little Cessna that he flew himself, or did he have a pilot?
His girlfriend's brother was a pilot and owned multiple planes, and he was taking them around on little trips.
By himself?
Unclear if Keys went alone with the brother, but we know that Keys often committed crimes while on vacation with family and friends, so that doesn't necessarily, like, negate criminal activity that he was with Kimberly, but if he was on his own, it definitely opens up the pool of what he was able to do.
That's incredible. Have you been able to speak with the brother?
I just reached out to him. I was timing my contact with him, so he didn't have enough of an opportunity to get ahead of things before I ran that episode. So I've just reached out, and we'll see what he has to say for himself.
Wow, could you imagine that? Like, do you think he had any clue?
No, I don't think anyone had any clue, which is probably why there's been this ongoing question of, like, why is Kimberly being so secretive? Who is she trying to protect? And it's like, oh, this is why. She's trying to protect her little brother, who had no clue. But, you know, it's frustrating that they are not sharing things with the FBI, but I also get it. This is probably really traumatizing for them.
Wow. That's absolutely wild. So no record that Keys could even fly a plane himself. I know I'm harping on the him being alone thing, but I'm just curious.
No.
Okay. So he likely didn't take it alone then.
Yeah, no.
Wow. But yeah, as you said, that doesn't really matter. That's incredible. Do you know where they went in the plane?
Well, so this particular plane, the plane that he was most frequently flying at this point, could only go, I think, 450 miles before it needed to refuel. So obviously he could go anywhere, but, you know, from a practical viewpoint, he's probably only going 450 miles from Sacramento, which is actually three hotspots that Keys was most active in, which is like the Salt Lake area, the Riverside, California area, and the Washington Peninsula. So it's getting him to those places, and it's very reasonable for him to be like, hey, can you take me to Salt Lake City? Here's some cash. I don't want to fly commercial, because he's a bank robber, so he always has cash on hand, and that way he's avoiding any sort of digital footprint, and he's using this stolen cash, so there's no transactional records of him doing anything. So it was a really great way for him to evade any police accountability later on.
And what year, what time frame was he probably flying around?
2006 until his arrest.
2006 until his arrest. I know that after 9/11, because I knew a guy who was like an amateur pilot, and he told me after 9/11 it was like a completely different story. Like they pretty much were like, oh, you're going up today? Okay, sign in, sign out. After 9/11, it was a lot more strict, and they had a lot more regulations that were put in place, obviously. So I wonder if there's any paperwork. Oh, what? No, yeah, you already looked into that. You said that they're only required to keep it for 3 years?
Yeah, and what I found was as long as it was domestic, they just needed to write the plane's information, the pilot's information, and number of souls on board. They didn't even need to give a manifest with names. So
really?
Yeah. Which was shocking to me.
Shocking. Could you imagine doing something in your life like you're podcasting, right? And could you imagine, you know, your partner's brother saying, oh, I got a full-blown podcast studio for you to use whenever you want. This is a serial killer whose partner's brother says, yeah, I got a plane. Pretty much no record on it. You guys want to go up anytime you want? He was like, sure.
Also, just because I've been doing tons of research into true crime is wild, you become, you know, a mini expert in a lot of strange things. But, like, I know basically the FBI or the HSA has a file with every flight any of us have ever taken on a commercial airline, but yet there's no accountability on private planes, which is crazy. And, you know, we can go into the, I guess, economic discrimination involved in that. but it's really messed up.
Yeah, that's a good point. And how did you find out about this? How did you learn about it?
So I have a few sources who wish to remain anonymous, but are close to various parts of the story. And one of them reached out to me, gosh, almost a year ago, and said, oh, check out Sacramento. Keys had access to a private plane. And this source had been probably the least consistent of the sources I have. Like, whenever I put anything to air, I always make sure I can corroborate it as to a certain extent. And I'd been able to do that with this source, but this source kind of came and went. They were a little bit flaky. And when I saw that, I also was like, I don't know how you would have this information based on your familiarity to things. So I kind of wrote it off because it seemed so implausible. And then a few months ago, a different source who would absolutely know this, who did not know that other person, came forward and said, hey, I think you should have this information. Keys flew multiple times in Kimberly's brother's private plane. They're based in Sacramento. And so when that person had some of the same details as this other person, I was able to go track down her brother, find out he was a pilot. He did have these two planes. I was able to see where they were flying in and out of currently. And I was able to see when he bought them. And so once I was able to corroborate all that, I was good. And then it was sending a fax to this small airport being like, have you seen this man? Which felt strange and a little out of my depth. And waiting for hopefully like a receptionist to come back and be like, oh yeah, that I recognize that guy. And then that final step was reaching out to the brother, which I have not heard back from him yet.
So when you reach out to a place like an airport, how do you do that? Do you write them a letter or do you email?
I sent an email and then I sent a fax, which was a strange thing. I have not sent a fax in like 15 years.
Where did you find a fax machine?
you can install them on your laptop. Like it was like a $30 program and they basically like will fax a PDF somewhere.
Okay.
It's a pretty
wow.
remarkable technology though when you think about it, a fax, like that's pretty cutting edge.
It is.
it does feel almost more magical than an email with a picture, but yeah, for mm-hmm. some reason, but Josh, your road trips, where were you driving around and who were you driving around with?
Well, I was driving around with our good friend Kaz on the first road trip, and it was great to have her because I'm a little bit of a chicken, and I won't talk to strangers generally, and I won't like go tromping around on property or into the woods. So she was kind of my motivator in some of those senses. But we went to Albany, we went to Tupper Lake, we went to Keene, New York, where we think something may have happened. We went to Constable, to his cabin up in the woods. We went to Essex, where the couriers were abducted and eventually murdered. And that was our first trip, and then I've gone on two subsequent trips to some other towns that will come up in the podcast later, and we are planning a Maine trip and a Pennsylvania trip. So we are getting around.
Wow, that's a massive trip. I lived in Keene.
New York?
Oh, I thought you meant Keene, New Hampshire.
No, New York.
He never listens to me either, Josh.
And I have to say that Lance's background is just an ongoing slideshow of photos with me, and it's making me deeply uncomfortable.
Sorry. No, actually, what should be making you uncomfortable is this is the last time we spoke in Worcester. I'm literally wearing the same thing.
Oh, I am too. I mean, you can't see it because I'm in a dark room, but yes, I'm wearing the exact same clothes.
Well, it feels like we're in Wormtown again.
It does.
In your travels, did you go to Vermont too?
Yeah. So I went to Essex twice, and then I went to a town called Brattleboro, which is actually not far from where I am currently. And that was a really eye-opening trip, and I don't want to get into too many details because we will deep dive that in the show at some point. But that was really weird because Google Maps did me dirty and sent me on this back road when I was like, the rule with Kaz and my partner was like, just be off the road by sundown. And sun was setting. I was an hour and a half from home, and I was like, all right, it's time to go home. And then Google Maps like sent me out into the woods on a dirt road, and some jerk. And I grew up in a small town with country roads, and I know people out there are assholes, but some jerk like turned on their brights and like got up onto my bumper and was, you know, trying to intimidate me. But we all know that Keys used to do that to try to run people off the road. And I've at that point had spent like 48 hours just really living in the Keys world. And I was like, oh, great. So now here I am in the woods where we believe Keys actually did abduct someone, and someone is trying to intimidate me. And so I was going like 55 on a dirt road through the woods, like winding roads in the middle of the night. And it was a little bit terrifying.
Oh, you sped up? Yeah. Instead of like pulled over to let him go? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I should have pulled over to let him go, but just that off chance that, you know, he was a psychopath, which I don't think he was, but that's where my brain was at the moment.
That's where your brain should be. I mean, first of all, you don't have to put your high beams on somebody. That's an aggressive move. So if he wasn't a full psychopath, he was like 30 to 40% there.
Nonviolent psychopath.
And Brattleboro is a great little town.
It is.
I'm curious to hear your story about Brattleboro. See, that's very close to Keene, New Hampshire. Yeah, it's probably half hour.
Oh, okay.
You kind of came pretty close to Brianna Maitland's crash site, and even Maura Murray's crash site to a degree. How likely is it, do you believe, that Keys was in those areas?
Kaz and I went to Brianna's site, and I went to Maura Murray's, which was a very strange experience. The Keys of it all, and I know this is a very controversial opinion, and I would say I'm at 50% either way, with Keys being involved in Brianna's disappearance. The thing that struck Kaz and Kaz was a lot more skeptical than I was about his possible involvement, is Keys had a cabin in Constable, New York, and his family had a cabin in Smyrna, Maine. And as you know, the road that Brianna disappeared from and her car was found on is not like a highway. You kind of have to know where that road is. The most direct route from Keyes' cabin to his family's cabin goes right past the Black Lantern Inn and the crash site. So we were a little weirded out by that. And then, you know, there are all these variables with Keyes' crimes that come up in that, like an abandoned farmhouse and moving cars and staging cars to look like accidents and potentially running people off the road. There were sightings of Keyes within a mile of a diner that she worked at a few weeks before she went missing, asking people how deep Lake Champlain was in certain points and asking people if anyone would know they disappeared. You know, just common small talk you make with strangers.
Wow, sorry, let me hold on for a second there. So that was the other job that Brianna Maitland had? I forget the name of that diner.
Yeah, I forget it too, but it's in St. Albans, like downtown St. Albans.
Yeah, and I don't think Brianna worked there for long, too. It was maybe no more than a month.
Yeah.
Wow.
So while she was working there, there's a sighting just down the road from it with Keys asking some strange questions. And
where, sorry to interrupt, where did you get that information that there was a sighting that close to the diner?
In the FBI files.
Oh, okay.
And then there's this, you know, that the FBI allegedly have ruled Keys out, which is interesting because it's not anywhere in the files. In fact, her case does not come up at all in the files, which means one of two things is it's not in it, or they redacted it. And I do know the two other cases that have been entirely redacted from the files, the FBI believes he was involved in. So that has always been a little suspicious to me. They've said in interviews that he can be ruled out because of a phone ping that places him elsewhere. But I have all their recorded phone pings, and there aren't any on that day. So the way they talk about it is interesting to me. And I do know there's another case where they said that they had ruled Keys out, but a month after they made that statement, they had flown to this tiny town and were like doing DNA testing and digging around. So, yeah, I make of that what you will.
Wow, I'm a bit surprised, because we had heard they had ruled her out, so we really didn't look at it much at all, to be honest. And I guess one other reason is because of the amount of shady people around Brianna in her life at that time. There's enough to fill an Agatha Christie murder mystery.
Yeah, I think it's hard, because with James Koenig, Samantha Koenig's father, had Keys not been arrested, they probably would have arrested him. He was their lead suspect. They were filing warrants on him. They thought for sure he was involved because he was a shady character. She also had a bunch of shady characters. So Occam's razor is like, yeah, it's probably the shady characters in her life, but that is by no means exculpatory for a serial killer. And to me, there's a lot of coincidences, so I don't think that Keys should be ruled out just because there are other likely suspects. And, you know, the Spear case is another great example, which is also a controversial case. And I would say I'm 50-50. I wouldn't be surprised if it was him, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't. And that's how I feel about Brianna.
And he was asking people during this particular sighting how deep Lake Champlain was?
Yeah, so he has this thing that comes up constantly where he will just, like, bump into a stranger in the woods and be like, hey, how's it going? Would anyone know if you disappeared today? Do you know how deep this lake is?
He asked people that?
Yeah, constantly.
What would you do? What would happen if you disappeared today?
Would anyone know if you disappeared today?
What?
Yeah.
It's an icebreaker.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of like, welcome to Wormtown.
Yeah, when I'm going through the drive-thru at Dunkin', I'm like, thanks. By the way, would anyone know if you disappeared today? And people are really good-natured about it.
Yeah, and how deep is Lake Champlain? That's really weird. Okay, what about Maura's case? So you mentioned that you went by her crash site?
Yeah, I went by just because I was in that neck of the woods. And it was very, you know, I've heard a lot about the mythology of how creepy that place is, and I've always a little disregarded it, but I will say as soon as I got in there, it was very unsettling. I got a few phone calls from a local area code, which I know no one who has that area code. I didn't answer them, but I was like, oh, that's weird that, like, as soon as I'm in Haverhill, all of a sudden, what is it, like 614 starts calling?
603, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah,
so that
all New Hampshire 603.
Yeah, I just went out of curiosity. I don't think Keys is involved. The rule with his timeline is, like, use it as a foundation, but not as a concrete rule. The timeline would make it very challenging because he was in Salt Lake City the day before and the day after. To me, it's just too messy for Keys. You know, Keys would not have let a victim talk to somebody else, or if they did, he would have killed that person as well. And there was so much commotion around her, even though it was just a short period of time that she was out on the bend. It just, nothing about it feels like Keys. He would not have left that car in that state. It never really screamed Israel Keys to me.
Okay, but he did refer to the Northeast and New Hampshire, I think specifically, as his stomping ground. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you know about that?
Well, I mean, we can place him on that highway as well many times. he said he was most comfortable killing people in Washington and the Northeast. So there is that. And that's a time when he started to be more active. He was most active in 2010, 2011, but in 2003 to 2005, he had just gotten out of the military. He, according to him, not murdered anyone in 3 years. So he was really working out his frustrations, I guess. And we just found out that he had a secret girlfriend in Maine who he was going back to visit very frequently, which the timeline does not show. So he was out there and he was driving around and he had multiple kill kits out there. Two, they've been able to recover. He's confessed to several more. It's not out of the realm of possibility. I just, this guy was like a ghost. And for her to have crashed and then talk to people and be seen by lots of people just doesn't add up to me.
Yeah, I hear that. You mentioned the kill kits. Do you know where they were buried?
Yeah, we know there was one in Winooski River Park in outside of Burlington, Vermont. There was one in Blake Falls Reservoir up in New York, outside of like Lake Placid, Saranac Lakes. We have evidence that there was one in Maine, and it seems very likely there was one in my neck of the woods, so kind of like Vermont, Massachusetts, New York area. But I wouldn't be surprised if there was more. He talked about how he had stolen dozens of guns in his life, and every gun that he stole ended up in a kill kit, and they've only recovered, I think, like 8 guns. So to me, that means there's a lot more kill kits out in the world.
And you said that he had a secret girlfriend in Maine. Do you know where in Maine she was?
Yeah, she was outside of Smyrna, which is just outside of, I guess, Nova Scotia.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So this is like super like northeastern Maine?
More eastern than north. It's about an hour and a half from Bangor.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's a haul. That's a hike from anywhere in New Hampshire. And where was the kill kit in Maine? Do you know?
We believe in that area. In the
oh, gotcha.
Area.
That makes sense.
But, you know, the Burlington, Vermont one is in Keys geography, not far from New Hampshire. So, you know, he's in the area. It's a hot spot. There's a lot of activity there. We have him on that road multiple times. Is it possible? For sure. I would not be surprised if it was him, but it just, the crime scene or the accident scene, however you perceive it, does not look like Keys to me.
Yeah, that's fair. He was in Manchester, New Hampshire. It seems like here, flying into Manchester in 2004.
Yeah, as far as I know, and I'm fairly confident I know this accurately, they only found 3 kill kits.
Jeez. So nothing about Mora's accident speaks to Keys to you, but Brianna's is a little bit more, Keys-centric. Is there any other unsolved in the area that you might look at and say this needs a little bit more investigation regarding Keys?
Oh, for sure. There's a case in Brattleboro, which will come up in the show. There's 2 cases in the Amsterdam Johnstown area of New York. There's a unidentified body that was found in Maine. Someone found him digging in the woods in rural Pennsylvania. We have the Deborah Feldman case, and the way he talks about her remains leads me and some of the researchers on my team to believe that there are multiple remains buried there. So yes. And I want to say, like, going up to the after the accident, a lot of that does look like Keys. He tried to run people off the road. He would stalk people at ATMs. He targeted women driving alone late at night in rural areas. So that does scream Keys. It's just, to me, it's what was left behind afterward doesn't. As to where Brianna, and I understand there are some comparisons, but just the distance from which she was last seen to where her car was found, the abandoned farmhouse, the way the car was parked there, that looks like Keys. And the fact that they've found evidence, but nothing so far. I heard recently that they found some DNA has been linked to anybody. That feels like Keys, not just leaving like a chaotic mess. He was very neat and tidy and clean.
Have you talked to anybody from the Black Lantern? Maybe people who worked there when Brianna worked there, and asked them if he looked familiar at all?
Not yet, but that's it's on my very long list of things I need to do this season.
You need to hire an admin.
I do need to hire an admin.
But I wonder, would that be something Keys would do, to go into a restaurant in a small town and scope it out?
I don't know that he would go into the restaurant, but you know, his last confirmed victim, Samantha Koenig, we have dozens of reports of him sitting in his car outside of the coffee stand that he abducted her from. And we also know he drank a lot of coffee, and he went to the Home Depot across from where she worked almost on a daily basis. So he probably at some point met her or got coffee from her and then staked out that spot. There's reason to believe he was stalking the couriers for some time before he abducted them. So yeah, there's a precedence for it for sure. And even the Susie Lyle case, which I think he did, people saw him staking out parking lots near where she was abducted from, and she also told a friend that someone had been following her. So if that was Keys, that adds up. So yeah, it would absolutely add up for him to just be lurking around the area, trying to see if there was someone abductable, or maybe he had his eyes on her and trying to find the best place to abduct her.
And the murder of the couriers, can you tell us a little bit about that neighborhood? You said you visited that house. Is that like a wide open area, or is that like more of a suburban neighborhood?
It's a suburban neighborhood, which really struck both of us. We wanted to drive down and look at the house without being, you know, creeps, basically. And we turned onto the street, and there were like children playing everywhere and neighbors talking to each other, and you can see into everyone's backyards. And that struck us as like, oh, this is not just a neighborhood, this is a community. And that felt very brazen, especially because we know that he had been in their backyard for hours waiting for the neighbors to go to bed, and you can see their backyard from almost any point on the street. So he's in this community where people know each other and talk to each other, and that felt very uncomfortable. And then also just the fact that he had said he just went to a random house. He had walked the neighborhood for a long time and was looking for a house with an attached one-car garage with no cars in the driveway, and this was the first one he came upon. And that's just unequivocally false. We drove the path from his hotel to the courier's home, and there are probably 10 to 15 houses like that before we got to the courier. So we believe he was stalking them. He even said at one point, like, well, I knew it was safe to go into their house. And they were like, what do you mean? And he was like, oh, I mean, I just figured it was. So
why them then, in your opinion?
He had a thing for couples. He also would stake out university parking lots, and they both worked at the nearby university. So perhaps he encountered them at some point there. I think they looked pretty harmless. They were older, they both had some health issues, they didn't have a dog, they didn't have kids, they I think just seemed like really easy targets for him. And because he had this thing with couples, and this was a couple that he could easily overpower, I think that just suited his needs.
I have a personal question. Did you ever think, like, 10 years ago that you would be getting so deep in the mind of one of the most prolific serial killers in American history?
I didn't think that 5 years ago. I laugh about this all the time because, you know, 10 years ago I was working in fashion, and now this is what I do. And it's very, very strange. And it's very strange when people are like, as an expert on the Keys case, and I don't think of myself that way, but I guess I am. Because I don't think anyone else has spent more time doing this.
As an expert in fashion, what do you think about my sweater?
Well, I'm definitely not an expert in fashion, but, you know, it suits you.
Oh, wow.
I think it looks better on you now than it did a year and a half ago, Lance.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, you filled it out better.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so as far as 112, why? How do you have him on that road? I'm curious about that.
We have him at a dance in Deerfield, Massachusetts. We have him in Brattleboro, and we have him driving directly from there to the Smyrna cabin. And if you map that out, it goes down that road. We also have him flying into Manchester, driving to Constable, and I believe that one, if you map that out, it has him going that road as well. So there are multiple places where he's driving to from where the quickest, most reasonable route would be that road.
Interesting. Question about your methods in which you obtain your records. When you get something back from the FBI, do you ever get it back with a note maybe questioning what you're using it for, or do you just get it back as straight files?
With the FBI, it's always been straight files, but we did have an experience recently where there was a missing persons case out of the border of Pennsylvania and West Virginia, which has already muddied just the filing process, so I can't imagine what the investigation actually looked like. But they responded and said, well, this is a active, or it's an open but inactive case, and we are only sharing files with journalists who have a strong lead. And we said, oh, well, we do. I'm a journalist. I do have a strong lead. And they were like, can you explain it? And so I wrote out, like, oh, this woman's name was on his computer. Everything about her abduction or disappearance matches what we know about his MO. She disappeared from a parking lot late at night on a state line. Her car was never recovered. She was never recovered. Also, did I mention she was on his computer? And a day after we sent that, they responded to the FOIA request with, due to a new lead in this case, we are no longer sharing files with journalists.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite a compliment.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, they did us dirty a little bit. And then Michigan would send us more. They didn't seem, it just seemed like curiosity questions, like, oh, what are you looking into? Or like, oh, do you need these files too for your investigation? Like, they seemed to be excited to be participating, but I think that was just because it was from such a small town in the Upper Peninsula where they don't see a lot of activity.
So what's that coming up on this season? Is there anything, I know you don't want to give out any spoilers, but is there some tea that you can spill here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've already spilled some, which is we found out he was having actually multiple affairs with women and men all over the country. So that, I think, has added a new component to the investigation. We have found potential evidence. You know, obviously, I won't call it evidence until we can get DNA or fingerprints, but we found stuff that resembles stuff Keyes had in places we know he was, in places we know he generally disposed of weapons. That's coming up. We've got, I think, like 10 new missing persons cases that we're going to deep dive that a lot of them I'm very confident are Keyes, and some I think it's worth looking into. And then we're going to circle back to, I think, 6 or 7 cases I covered in the first 2 seasons where we have new evidence or we have new leads. So I think it's going to be a really great mix of like the standard, here's a missing person, could Keyes be responsible, as well as like, here's new information we have that really contextualizes a lot of what we thought we knew or a lot of the investigations we've already done.
Very cool. And also, you mentioned that he had multiple affairs, including affairs with men. Are there any male victims that you are looking at that might be? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I believe he had more male victims than female victims. And we're going to talk about, you know, there's this mythology about Keyes that he killed at random and he had no victimology. And it just, the more we're learning about him, the more it's just not true. So we'll talk about victimology and, you know, some of the similar traits a lot of his victims had, particularly men of a certain age, which could also just be symptomatic of where he was looking for victims, which was the woods. But they, you know, we've just noticed a lot of patterns in the victims that we absolutely can link to him and those that we very confidently believe he was involved in their disappearances.
Wow. Excellent work.
Yeah. Fantastic work. You, we're happy to, call you colleagues, Josh. You do a great show.
Well, thanks. I just have to say it's more about resources. Like, I have all the time in the world, and because I have a strange obsession with this case, like, I've been able to spend, I guess now 7 years, like looking at every detail. And people ask if I'm frustrated with the FBI or think they did a bad job. And the answer is always no. They have limited resources. And once he's dead, like they don't have all the time in the world to look into it anymore. So I think it's just if you spend enough time with a case and really divorcing yourself from it and also divorcing the grisly details from it and just looking at it like in a very analytical way, you will find stuff. So it's less about me and more about just the time I've invested into it. ¶¶